Null hypothesis testing. The test of the null hypothesis can be expressed two different ways. I really don't care, but you have to know if your audience cares. Are we talking about r equals 0, or are we talking about r squared equals 0? We can't be having a mathematical discussion because they're the same thing. All right? You translate from one to the other. That leads to my favorite formula. So this whole discussion about r's versus r squares is an issue of bragging rights and communication. The people who like r squared tend to have bigger r squares. People who like r tend to have smaller r's. It just comes down to that. The people who want to use r squared typically will talk about how it's important to recognize when a relationship is really big enough to matter. And that there's a lot of small relationships, even if they're non-zero, that just really aren't big enough to care about. People who like r typically say exactly the opposite. There are a lot of very small effects that are very meaningful. And that if we square that, it looks really shitty. Okay, that correlation of 0.1 is an r-square of 0.01. They both mean 1% of the variance. They both mean that damn envelope's almost a circle. But sometimes being able to pick up 1% of the variance changes the world. Especially if you're talking about a criterion variable that has multiple causes. And one of the first places that this argument took place was in non-experimental social psychology. One of the next places that it took place was in education. These people were working in areas where dozens, scores, maybe hundreds of causes of the behavior they're looking at, and no experimental control. They don't have random assignment, they don't have matching, they don't have procedural control, they got squat. So all of those dozens, scores, hundreds of causal variables are in action, but the model has, maybe 6 or 7 in it. You're not going to get an R square of 1. And if you can reliably come up with 5 or 6% of the variance, you've got something you didn't have before. So have your R square fight with whoever you like, but just remember, mathematically they're the same thing. And you can express the null hypothesis test either way. SPSS and most other packages, including Excel, gives you a p-value when you do your correlation. But I want to show you what the F-test would look like, because there's going to be a whole family of these F-tests that test 15 or so different hypotheses as we work our way through this. R squared over 1 minus R squared divided by N minus 2. R squared is the variance accounted for. Pretty simple idea. The fit of the model, the systematic part of the variance, the effect part of the variance, traditional resident of the numerator. Well, if r squared is the variance accounted for, 1 minus r squared is the variance not accounted for. It's error variance. It's what the model didn't accomplish. And that is the normal resident of the denominator. What the model does divided by what the model doesn't do. Taking the sample size into account. Okay? Now, like I say, we're going to see all sorts of these Fs as we work our way up through. This one does just what you think it does. Some of the others don't. We'll argue for caution when looking at some of these F tests. I tend not to use proper mathematical statistical language when I talk about null hypothesis testing. And the reason is we are not proper mathematical statisticians. When a statistician is done and has their p-value, they're done. They write you a bill, they go have a beer, they're done. When we get a p-value and start to interpret that p-value, we have just begun our work. Doing the analysis is not the big deal. I can train reasonably bright sophomores to do all of the analyses that you'll learn how to do in here. The important part is being able to take those analyses back to the literature that gave the idea birth and know what it means. Whether you're a theorist or a practitioner, you've got to say to yourself, what do I know now that I didn't know before? Which boils down to, What have I found here that I trust, that I believe in, that I will act on? Those are the words I use that my statistician friends hate. Okay? Now, the knee-jerk response is P less than 0.05, believe, trust, act on. P greater than 0.05, not believe. Okay? One of my first math stat professors used to love to say, most of our data is self-report data with a single significant digit. If we have done a good job developing our measures, half of the variance is reliable and a quarter of the variance is valid. And now we're going to put it through a series of statistical analyses and argue about the third decimal of a fourth order statistic. Okay? What's really going to count, and the 941 folks are already sick of this, what's really going to count is consistency, replication, and convergent evidence. But when you run one study, you have to do something with the results of that one study. So here's the kind of language that I want you to think about. When you retain the null, you are concluding that the linear relationship between these variables in the sample is not strong enough to allow me to conclude that there's a linear relationship between them in the population represented by the sample. There's just not enough evidence here to act as if these variables are related. The evidence here is not strong enough to believe there's a relationship between them. Okay? Because that's what you got to do. Sample size becomes very important in these discussions of believe and not believe, act on and not act on. If you asked three friends for advice and two said one and one said the other, you're still pretty close to up a tree. Two out of three is statistically reliable by a two-cell chi-square test, goodness of fit test, but still not by much, and come on. If you asked 300 people, 300 of your closest friends, to give you advice, and 200 of them said one thing and 100 of them said the other, you'd be really comfortable. It's the same proportion. You've got to separate proportion from frequency and make sure you're paying attention to what you're using as evidence. All right? 2 out of 3, 200 out of 300, not the same thing. But they're the same proportion. And when you're making decisions about whether theory is going to change or stay the same, whether practice is going to change or stay the same, stop and think. Don't just look at the p-value and think about good old Jacob Cohen's small, medium, large and go rushing off to the discussion section. When you reject the null, you're concluding, acting as if you believe, are about to act on, are about to change theory or practice, that the linear relationship between these variables in the sample is strong enough to allow me to conclude there's a linear relationship between them in the population represented by the sample. There's a few things in these that we're hoping about. Does the sample really represent the target population? Is the sample big enough that a statistical conclusion is worthwhile? Oh, and by the way, we're measuring all of these variables. Is our measurement any good? Even though this course is going to tend to focus on the data analysis, I will occasionally draw you back and insist that you remember that the data come from somewhere. Okay? Unless you're dry labbing it. The data came from somewhere. Not from the stork. It's not found under a cabbage leaf. Mom doesn't bring it in wrapped in a pink blanket. It comes from some design, from some sampling, from some manipulation, from some measurement. And that's part of the conclusions that you draw, and it's why there's such an emphasis on replication and convergence. All right, effect significance versus effect size versus shared variance. The p-value tells the probability of making a type 1 error if you reject the null based on the sample data. What's the probability that if I reject the null, I screwed up and there's really no relationship between these variables? A p of 0.10 means if we reject the null based on these data, there's a 10% chance that there really is no relationship between the variables in the population. The usual accepted risk is our friend, p less than 0.05. R tells the strength and the direction of the bivariate relationship. Large enough to be interesting value may vary across research areas, but a common guide is Jacob Cohen's small, medium, and large. And that's based on, well, when Jacob came out with that, he was doing a lot of applied social psychology. And he thought that 1% of the variance was worth talking about, worth thinking about, worth keeping around. Notice he called it small. He didn't call it trivial. He didn't call it inconsequential. Small. There are some small, meaningful things. R square tells how much of the Y variability is accounted for, predicted from, or caused by X. And the difference between those three is the type of design you have. If you want to talk about X causing Y, you better have an experimental design without any confounds. So a 0.30 means that a correlation of 0.30 means that 0.3 squared, or 9% of the Y variability, is accounted for by X. If we translate Cohen and round things out, you see that we cheat a little bit on the medium. 0.3 squared would really be 0.09 or 9%, but usually that gets bumped up to 10. Nice round numbers, got to have round numbers. So you got to separate those three and make sure that you and whoever you're talking with are talking about the same thing. All right. Is age related to social skills? Based on the usual convention, is age related to social skills? All right. Is that relationship positive or negative? Positive. So when we describe this, we want to make clear that there is a relationship and that it's positive. Right? Now, the easy way to say it is there's a positive correlation between age and social skills. That's just turning those numbers into words. What I want you to do, and what I will insist on you doing in this first homework that comes out after Wednesday, is to translate that so someone who doesn't know anything about statistics knows what you mean. So how do we translate age and social skills are positively related? Well, we bring it down to the person level. We talk about a person, or we can talk about a group of people. We might say older people tended to have more social skills. Does that make sense? We might say, if we want to bring it down to the person level, if a person is older, they tended to have a higher social skills score. That's a much safer statement. Tended to have means not everyone did. That means, incorrectly, that we can probably find some younger people who have better social skills than some older people. Right? And remember how weak most of our correlations are. And so, admissions of that, by using words like tended to, are just a little more honest. Are practice and performance errors related? Positively or negatively? Negatively. So as practice goes up, performance goes... This is the participant part of the day. As practice goes up, performance tends to go... It's a negative correlation. As practice goes up, error tends to go down. As age goes up, performance tends to go down. Okay? Now. Wow. As age goes up, search time tends to go up. Now, when we have gender, whenever you have a binary variable, the first question you have to ask yourself is, how were they coded? Because how they were coded will have a deep influence on how that correlation is interpreted. In this case, males got the lower code, females got the higher code. Is there a relationship? Is it positive or negative? Positive means the people with the higher code tended to have higher scores. Does that make sense? This correlation cannot be used to tell us what's the mean difference between the two groups. On Wednesday, the regression weight will be able to tell us this. But the correlation just tells us about the direction and strength of the relationship, not the size of a mean difference. When we look at gender and performance, are they related? Positive or negative? That means in this case, females tended to perform poorer. And you know, now's a good time to bring that up too. You said lower, I said poorer. We have to be careful. Some measures are backwards from what we expect. In general, a scale or a measure is named for what larger scores mean. So if you take a depression measure, if you have higher scores, you're more depressed. But you have to be careful. It's not always that way. A lot of anxiety measures, for example, lower scores mean more anxious. And so the safe language to use is the language that's about the description of the data. Okay? That's safer. If you want to add valuing to that language, you may want to hold off for the discussion section. Because sometimes lower isn't poorer, sometimes lower is better. And then gender and practice. Is there a relationship between gender and practice? No. Now, are you supposed to reject the null with this p-value? No, less than 0.05. Remember what that p-value means. If we decided to reject the null, and we decided to interpret this correlation as meaning there's a relationship between gender and practice in the population, we have a 9.8% chance of a type 1 error. Okay? The p-value gives us very explicit information. It gives us more information than retain or reject. The p-value combined with a convention tells us whether to retain or reject. The p-value itself, again, tells us if we reject the null, what's the chance that we're making a type 1 error? Okay? Got to make sure that you pick up and pay attention to the specific information in each of the statistics that we'll play with.